I would say the first year that I came here, when I look back now, I actually suffered depression. When I came, how I had envisioned things in the reality of what I met in America, there was a big gap that was impossible to fill. Like I couldn't even fathom from how I was going to get to my 28 days have elapsed, and how am I going to get to a point where I'm now documented? So that honestly was I feel like a breaking point or my low point, and then coming to terms with I'm a whole licensed physician somewhere and I'm babysitting. And babysitting in America is not just reminding the baby. If the dog has to be let out, you have to open the door for the dog, and you have to do dishes, maybe vacuum there. So you feel like back home, you feel like a maid.
This is a Sorted Immigrant Stories podcast. My name is Zenith Mwangahamambamalao, and I am your host. And for those of you that are stopping by for the very first time, this is a podcast about immigrant journeys, the things I and others wish we knew. We have interviews and share conversations with immigrants from diverse backgrounds and countries as they share their own immigration stories. We explore struggles, triumphs, and cultural adjustments. We discuss identity, belonging, and community. And we also highlight successes and contributions to both American society and back home. And that's wherever home might be. We also review some books that touch on the immigrant story. So don't forget to rate and review, like, share, and subscribe to wherever you get your podcast from. Welcome to another episode, and today I have with me a dear friend of mine, Mutsa Mutengwa. She is going to grace us with her coming to America story. All right, Mutsa, say hello to our listeners.
Hello, listeners. It's a pleasure for me to be here. Thank you so much, Zenith, for inviting me. I was actually looking forward to this for a very long time, and I'm happy to share my side of coming to America.
Oh, okay, well, let's just do a little bit of an introduction. You are, I always say, a multifaceted woman. You're a modern day Renaissance woman. You wear many hats and you're building an impressive portfolio. So, I mean, alongside your husband, you have thriving Car for Hire business. You are entrepreneurial, you're doing real estate. You're a full-time student and a full-time employee. That's a lot of hats here in America, but you're managing everything. And we want to know how Mutsa got here. Take us back to the beginning. You're from Zimbabwe, right?
Yes.
And for those that may not know, where is Zimbabwe on the map?
So funny enough, whenever I tell people that I'm from Zimbabwe, people really actually they also don't know. But then I'll be like, "Do you know Robert Mugabe?" They'll be like, "Oh, Mugabe, yeah, Mugabe people." I'll be like, "Yes, yes." And it's always a mixed bag of emotions, either they like him or that they don't like him. Yeah. So Zimbabwe is in the southern African region. It's actually landlocked. So that means it's bordered by other countries. There's no sea or ocean on either sides or four sides of the country. To the very south, the southern border, that is South Africa. And then to the west is Botswana. To the east is Zambia. And then to the north is Malawi, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
So, we're neighbors.
We are
neighbors.
Neighbors.
You guys touch a bit of Malawi because Malawi is to the east of Zambia for us.
Boy, okay.
And you guys are the south of us.
Oh, yeah, yes, yeah. And we share the Victoria Falls.
You get the best view from Zimbabwe, but you
Yeah.
experience it in Zambia. So yeah, I guess we do share the Victoria Falls. What tribe are you from Zimbabwe, and how do we say hello?
Okay, I am Shona. There are two tribes basically in Zimbabwe, which is the Ndebele and the Shona. Of course, they are smaller, like sub tribes in each big subdivision, I guess. I am Shona and I am Zezuru. So to say hello, you say Hersi, which is informal. The formal way is Makadini.
Makadini. So did you say Zezulu or Zezuru?
With R.
Oh, so Zezuru.
Yes, it's Zulu.
Okay. So you say Makadini. That's how you say it. So tell us, in Zimbabwe, what was your favorite childhood game? What?
One. My favorite was, it's called Nodo. Nodo is you dig a hole in the ground, right? And then you take 10 little small smooth, we call them pebbles. You can call them pebbles. And then you throw the one stone up in the air. And then while it's up in the air, you have to like kind of do math. So you, in one swoop, you have to take nine out and then you leave one. So when you take the nine out, you have to catch the stone again, and then you throw it up in the air, and then you start taking one at a time, without looking when the stone, just do it like that. Like it's kind of like mathematical, and also like there's a technical skill to it. That was my favorite game.
That was one of my favorite games to play. So in Zambia, we called it Ichiyenga.
Ichienga, okay.
And there were different variations of it. So the one you're describing, you'd get any number of stones in a circle. You use the stone, you found a flat surface on cement, you drew a circle, and you put the stones inside the circle, and you use like an avocado seed for the stone, the thing that you throw up in
Throw
the
up.
air, what you're describing. Yes. So about fruits, what was your favorite fruit in Zimbabwe, or a wild fruit that you've never found here?
My goodness, so many. There's one we called Majanje or Janje. It's very sweet. I probably could look up the English name. I don't even know. All I can say, it has a brown, it's like little brown, little it has like little brown hard outer core. In the middle, it kind of has these chunky four seeds, and it's yellow and very sweet inside. I don't even know how. I don't
Was it
even know if it has
slimy or
any.
no?
It's not slimy. It's like porridgey, like
Okay.
it's not slimy.
Okay.
Maybe I can look it up. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, but that was my favorite. And then mango. I like mangoes, and I like sugarcane.
Okay. Right. And are the mangoes here? Do the mangoes here compare? Like when you eat?
No,
No, doesn't even come close.
then
Okay.
compare.
All right, that just tell us a bit about your childhood, like where you grew up, your family, how many were you when you went to high school, just briefly.
Briefly. Okay, so grew up in a family of three kids. Okay, mom and dad were alive. I mean, growing up. So I have two siblings. We went to like what we call a group A school, where you have a mix. In Zimbabwe, we have a good population of white people, so we were privileged enough to go to like a school where you're learning in class with probably 30% white, 70% black. We lived in a middle income residential area. Wasn't like tush, wasn't bad, wasn't the ghetto. My dad worked in the bank, mom worked in the bank. By the time I was like probably 8, dad got promoted at work. His income was better than mom's income. Mom became a stay-at-home mom. Life was very sweet because you come back from school. There's like a whole nice lunch, and there's always someone at school to watch your game, like watch you play your games, either swimming or whatever you're doing at school. So that was more like in terms of like during the school days. And then holidays, we always used to go either to the village, which we was very, very like exciting. We never really used to go to my father's side of the family, the village. We also to go to my mom's side of the family, to the village, where lots of fruit, lots of food, 24/7. Other kids, they're just playing. Yeah, so that was that. Or would go to an auntie's house for the summer, like the whole summer, like the whole maybe 6 weeks you're just there, and then you go back home when schools are just about to open. For high school, I went to an all-girls mission school closer to my mom's village, and there, we'll talk more about it maybe later, I became the head girl, more like a school president in America. I don't know if they have that. When I was only form three, which was like 15 years, and I was 15 years of age, and then went into high school, like form six to in the same school.
Okay.
In school, like in primary school, I wasn't like a really intelligent student, but I was in high school.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was more of it. Yeah. That's the gist of it.
Okay. So what was your system in high school? Because I heard you say you were 15 and you're already like school president.
Primary school is grade one to grade seven.
Okay.
Right. So that's from the age of six to the age of 12. And then from the age of 13, so 13 to 16, you are in secondary school.
Okay.
And then 17 and 18 by high school, that's A level. That prepares you for college. So when you're going to college, you're either 18 or 19 by the time you finish.
Okay.
I only became a school president at 15 when I was like form three, because we wrote this exam, and
right.
This exam was written in 1992. Like they took the same exam and gave it to us in 1992. And then 1992, everybody who wrote the exam, nobody got an A in it. And
wow.
Then for that same exam, I got a 98%. I don't know what to mean. And then the whole school was alarmed. Like, what? You got a 90? And then, yeah, in the whole region, no one had ever gotten an A. So it became a thing. Like, oh, yeah. And then they were like, oh, you're too brainy. Then they made me the school president. For 3 years, I was a school president.
After that, did you go to college right away? How did you make that decision? And how did you make the decision to go to medical school?
So for my secondary school, I was forced to write all the subjects, you know. People were like, let's see all the subjects that were offered in the Zimbabwean secondary school curriculum. So I wrote 13 subjects. I had 10 A's, 2 B's, and 1 C. And then I got to high school, which is form 5 and form 6, right? And then I wrote the Cambridge exams, and I wrote the Zimbabwean exams. The Cambridge exams, I did so well. I did biology and chemistry, and I had 14 points. And then for the ZIMSEC one, I had 13 points. So people are like, yeah, you have to apply to, you know, to medical school. So the medical school in Zimbabwe we only have one medical school in Zimbabwe. It takes a limited amount of students. And for you to get into the medical school, you have to have like 15 points. Other students will take like maths, biology, chemistry, physics. So they'll have like 20 points. So for you to get in, you have to be like exceptional. So I didn't get in. And then one of my friends was like, you should apply to America. You know, and then because I didn't get into to the medical school in Zimbabwe, so I applied to UCLA. Is it the one in California?
UCLA, yes.
Yes, I got in. And then I remember FedEx came with the acceptance letter and everything. And then the letter is so long. When I opened it, and then there were so many other letters, you know, they gave me like a 15% scholarship, but the yearly tuition was like 37,200 and something. I don't think even our house was worth that much at that
time.
But it was a lot of money. That was, and 15% wasn't even going to cut it. So one day I was looking through the paper and I say, cheap medical education in Europe. I was like, what? And then I saw Ukraine. And then I started to follow through. I applied. Tuition was 3,500 for a semester. And they had like you could do partial payments until you're done. I was like, okay, there I go. So I left Zimbabwe at 19 and I relocated to Europe, to Ukraine.
Wow. 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 So when you were going to Ukraine, were your parents on board with that?
No. No.
You know, African parents. I remember my mom, she said to me, "You are going to this country, but you're going without my blessing." I remember her saying that. She said, "Who have you ever had? People go to the UK, people go to Canada, New Zealand, Australia, America. Who have you ever had who's going to Ukraine?" But sometimes, you know, I'm a person of faith. Your path might not be something that's common to other people, but it's your path to walk. So I felt like this was my path to walk. And I did it, and it worked out.
It was very brave, but good for you. And it's important to know that there are many places that people can go to, right? It's just not the United States. There are many other places that people bypass, especially if you're looking at cost. You'd even gotten an opportunity to go to UCLA before Ukraine, but the cost was very high. And you're like, well, let me go somewhere else where the money makes sense.
Makes sense.
The math is mathing.
Yeah, USA.
And when I got there, funny enough, I was the only Zimbabwean. Even at the embassy, I'm like, I've never had a Zimbabwean go to Ukraine. And then most of my family, nobody, actually everybody except for my sister, nobody wanted me to go there. Like, no, just stay. You know, you'll get married to a rich man. They'll take care of you. You can just do something else. You can do accounting. You can do business studies. But I don't know where I got the courage and the oomph and everything. I just wanted to leave and I wanted to go. I thought, okay, I'm a doctor. People have already named me doctor. I have to follow through. The idea stuck with me even from the probably age of 14. Like, okay, I'm going to be a doctor. So if that was the only route, I just had to go. But was I scared when I landed in Ukraine? Of course, things became real.
So,
yeah, but I was, my family didn't want me to go there. All of them.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what was life there now like as a student when you got there? What surprised you? What impressed you?
What surprised me was how backward Eastern Europe is. It's very, infrastructure is very bad. I mean, so their infrastructure is bad, but things there work. They have, like, you know, they have the trains that, you know, we call them tram, the ones above the road, not underground. They have others underground and stuff. Of course, they are a little bit more advanced in terms of, like, comparing Zimbabwe and Ukraine, but in terms of infrastructure, it's like you think they are just surviving like a big war. Maybe even after World War II, they didn't put too much energy into redoing the infrastructure. They do have some new buildings, of course. They have like one street with these nice fancy buildings, but outside that one street, it became so, I don't know how to even explain it. And then I was surprised that 90% of the people, they don't speak English.
Okay.
So that was another shocking thing. And then when I got there, it was in September, it was cold. I never experienced that piercing, like it gets to your bone. And the jacket that I came with from Zimbabwe didn't even cut it. So that was very, and then the other thing was like, people would like stop and stare like a black person, like they'd never, there are people in Eastern Europe that have never seen a black person. So That was another thing. It was very surprising. But by the time I was in second year, third year, there were more Africans. I trust my West African people.
Yeah. Find them everywhere.
Now you see another color, another like caramel color. Yeah. But that was the one thing that was very surprising. The infrastructure to me, I was like, this is not the Europe that I thought, but everything works. Like their system works better than Africa and things are way cheaper. Like I cannot even express how cheap things are. It's cheaper. Like I used to live in a very nice big, an apartment here in America that would probably be $2,500. I used to pay $250 a month.
Really?
Yeah, maybe it would even be like 3,500.
And even
the only thing is, you go there for you to practice as a physician there, the chances are slim to none.
Okay.
Because you get people who, most of them, they just feel like black people are inferior. So no one wants to be in your care. Okay. Like no one wants you to be their doctor. They'll have all kinds of, so you go there, you finish school. Yeah. It's cheap. But then the question then becomes, what next?
What about to go back home? Like you finish there and go back home. Like,
yeah, you can finish and go home. Definitely. You can finish and go back home to Zimbabwe to start to practice. But then it becomes, you have to write these exams, you have to pass the exams, and then you can then join the other students. So you probably will be like a year behind because you have to go and sit and study for this one exam, which is very difficult. You know, African exams. Yeah, I trust my African exams. Yeah, so you lose a year. You could have been like a year into residency, but you lose a year because you're studying for that exam and trying to pass the exam, and then you get into the cohort that's behind you. It's possible you can still even go to South Africa, but South Africa has so many
layers things
that
as well.
You have to do. Yeah, but okay. Yeah. You still can go elsewhere and practice. You can even come to the United States and practice.
Okay. So tell us, so then when did the idea again of coming to America start brewing, and how did you make that transition?
I remember it was 3 months, 3 months into, maybe four, into me like graduating, getting out of med school. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to a cousin, a very good cousin of mine, mm-hmm. and things in Zimbabwe then were bad. Were really bad. And she asked me, I was like, so you're about to graduate, what next? And then I said, yeah, I'm going to come home. I'm going to work at Parinyatwa. Parinyatwa is the big regional, like the one hospital, the one government hospital that everybody in the country just, you know, goes to seek treatment. That's where you find all the good doctors, right? And I was like, oh, I'm going to go and study and do my residency at Parinyatwa. She told me, forget that. Do anything else. Don't come home. She was like, the people here are suffering, like going through it. I don't even think if you went to med school, you come here, because back when, before I left, doctors were making good money. Then doctors are not being paid. They're now making $300 a month. Insurance companies are not paying them their locum. We'll talk about that maybe later. Yeah, but so she just drilled it in me, like, don't come home. And then when she said, don't come home, I started thinking, okay, what can I do? And then I thought, okay, I started reaching out to my friends who were in other countries. So I had friends over here. They were like, yeah, come over here. There are so many foreign trained physicians, you know, blah, 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 blah. That's the story just ended there. There are so many foreign trained physicians. You can transition and come, just come here, come here. Then I was like, okay, let me go apply for the visa. Mm-hmm. The visa, honestly, they only asked me 3 questions and then they said, approved. It was easy. Maybe it was, for me, it was easy. I have friends that were denied. Okay. But let me say this. When I go to Europe, I didn't have money to go back home during the summer months. So I used to like travel within Europe, and then I used to like go work. Maybe I'll go work maybe in Austria, go do a little part-time here, part-time there. You know, and then so I had so many visas within Europe, right? Okay. So when I went to the American embassy, they saw that I had so many other visas. I'd been traveling, so they were like, "Oh, she's a frequent traveler." So only asked me 3 questions, like, "Where am I going? Who am I going to? Where am I going to stay? Mm-hmm. And when am I going to come back?" That's it.
So I had this visa was a visitor's visa, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at the time you were getting this visa, did you really understand like what your friend had told you? You come here, you come and, you know, you can transition. Did you understand like what that meant? Or you just thought, okay, I'll go, you know, get my visitor's visa, I'll go and I'll change.
So she didn't explain anything. Okay. It was like, come, there are so many foreign trained physicians here. They are making buku money. Life is good. And then of course it's America. You get excited. So there was no info. The story ended there. Come here.
Okay.
I will introduce you to other doctors that are here, and then they can show you the way. Okay.
Got you. All right. So you landed.
I landed, my friend.
You landed. We met the wonderful Mutsa. And now you're thinking, okay, now I want to work as a doctor. So what steps did you take? And then what challenges did you find? And what did you learn about the process?
Number one, I want to say something before even the process. When I came here, they nearly turned me around. I was at the airport in Dallas for 4 to 5 hours. The mistake that I made was I had one bag, of course, but in that one bag was my birth certificate, was my high school diploma, was my medical degree. Every document pertaining my life was in that bag. And just because I was coming from Eastern Europe and America and Eastern Europe, you know, they have their issues. Right. They had to open my bag and look through everything that I had. And then they found those documents. I'm like, if you're just a visitor, bye. Why do you have all this from your birth, driver's license, primary school, high school, you know, medical school? Everything, every document you might want to call regarding my, like, I had it. So they were like, you know what, we don't buy your story. And there's this one African-American guy, he just said, you know what, I'm going to give you benefit of the doubt, but your story is not adding up. So I'm going to just stamp and that's just let you up. But then I would say if anybody would want to come and that's their situation, FedEx your documents, send them via FedEx through to somebody you trust, and then they'll hold them for you. So you just come in here, you just have your clothes, you just have your bag with your clothes. That's it. So that was my airport story. But fast forward to how then did I still, I'm not practicing. How many years? It's been almost 8 years in the United States. Am I practicing? I'm not, I am working in the health field, but not what I went, not doing what I went to school for. The thing is, when you come here, the one thing that people overlook, you have to have a game plan. And your game plan needs another game plan. That game plan B needs a game plan C. And these three game plans, they need a lot of financial backing. If not, they need a sponsor. So you have to write the exams, number one. You have to sit down and take the exams. The first exam, people, they don't really tell you. It takes about 10 to 12 months of studying for that one exam. And in those 10 to 12 months, you need at least a minimum of 6 to 10 hours of study time a day, every day. And maybe you give yourself Sunday or one day of the week to rest. But every day, it's like a full-time job to study. But as you are here, you want to study, like the whole day to study, you still have, the moment you land in America, you have bills. If you have a cell phone, you have a bill. Where you are living, I don't know, the situations are different, but you tend to have bills. So you now have to work and you have to study. It becomes like a little bit tricky. The best situation would be you're living with family and they support you and you can sit down and study. I have friends who had that situation, were in that situation, and they were able to, you know, study, get their exams out the way, get into residency, and then start working. But that wasn't my story.
Okay, so we'll go back just a little bit to the bags. When you got to the airport before you get into the medical school, it's very interesting what you said.
Mm-hmm.
Not too long ago, I met someone who was coming here as a visitor, but she had so many bags. But in those bags, she had food that people had sent her to bring to their family members. So you know how it is for us back home. You're coming, people know you're coming. Someone says, please carry a suitcase for me. I'll pay extra luggage, or, you know, carry this food product. So they asked at the airport, well, if you're just coming to visit, why do you have all these 10 bags? Well, it wasn't 10. I'm exaggerating.
Right.
And she said, no, I'm bringing food for my people. And they said, ah, but you said you don't know anybody here. You're coming here to visit. But she had to explain. She said, no, for us in our countries, when people hear you're going, there are people sending food for family members.
For family members.
Suitcases. So truly it's something to pay attention to when you're coming to your point about the bag, how much, and, you know,
what's in it?
And FedExing. Because, yes, those things can affect you and you can be turned around because of that.
Really? Yeah.
Now, getting back to transition, you know, to you're here now. You're on a visitor's visa. Could you do those exams on a visitor's visa, or did you have to change your status in order to even be able to sit for those exams?
So I was told about Kaplan. Kaplan is a center where foreign trained physicians go. They get a F1 visa and you can study for your exams. They have like a study plan that you can do, and then you do the study, you then you study, and then you write the exam, you take the exams.
The Kaplan Center in the DMV area is in Washington. So I went to Washington. I was given an extensive, you know, walk through the campus, how they do everything, how everything is scheduled. And after studying for this long, you can take your first exam. After studying for that long, you can take this exam. But the one thing, I remember the lady, she was just saying these big numbers, you know, in a, like money, like very lightly, like everyone can afford. I remember she's her saying, for step one, for us to apply for your F1 visa, you need to pay $10,000. I came to America with almost, I think, $1,000-something. I had nowhere close to $10,000. There was no one back home I was going to call for $10,000. And I knew that. So fast forward, the 28 days have elapsed, and then I get introduced to you. And then I remember we had a very extensive conversation about some form of game plan, some kind of get a little job, an under-the-table job, and figure things out. Yeah, so that was my introduction to do something in America, to find your way forward.
Wow. So $10,000 just to change to F1 student visa so that you can sit for those exams, you know, so you can pass them and then become a resident. And you have to pay even for those exams, right? It costs
money. Oh, yes. It's $1,000 per exam.
So you're talking maybe 20,000 upwards.
Yes.
Somewhere there. Okay. So the 20 days have gone. So this means you're now out of status.
Yes.
So what happens next? So how did you continue on that path, or did things then change? Like, how did you navigate that?
Things changed much, much later. With another help of another Zimbabwean lady, I walked in August of 2016, I walked across a stage graduating as a medical doctor. December of 2016, I was a babysitter. So that was I was undocumented at that time. I couldn't get a job legally. So I was working, you know, just helping people around the neighborhood that I was staying, because I didn't have a car. So I was going to places that I could literally walk to and babysit. The fortunate thing was most of the people that I was babysitting for were physicians. So they kept talking to me like, oh, you could do this, do that. But that was where I was. Like, I started off with babysitting. And then in terms of getting my documents, while I was working in 2017, I met my now husband. Well, we were in a relationship for a very long time, and eventually we got married. So that's the route that I took to become documented. But I was undocumented for a very long time.
We thank God. And as a resident, if that means that you could now apply for the exams without going through a program like Kaplan or ATI or any of these institutions. Okay, so then how did you get into real estate and the car for hire business?
Now looking back, I could have done things a little different. People were telling me like, oh my God, you have to go back to school, but school comes with student loans. So I avoided going to school in America because people were projecting the emotions about student loans. So I could have gone to school, honestly, but then kind of changed my pay scale where it was. But I decided, what else can I do besides going to, you know, going back to school to do anything? The lady that I used to work for, Dr. Dawn, she was a dermatologist. She had a lot of rental apartments in Baltimore and in New York. She used to talk about that all the time. The best way to make money in America is real estate. My best way to make money is in real estate. So when in between patients, I started to ask her questions. How do you go about this? So how do you buy the houses? What do you do? What do you do? How did you start? And then she gave me the encouragement to just whatever house in Baltimore that I could get, whether it's $5,000 and it's a house that burnt up, it's just a shell, just has four walls, buy it and slowly start, you know, repairing it. And I listened to her advice. The house that I bought, the very first house that I bought in Baltimore, was $11,000. Well, with taxes and liens and everything, it came up to $21,000. How did I save for that? That took 2 years for me to save to save the $21,000. And it took me another 1 year to renovate the house. And when I renovated the house, I did it all cash, and I worked three jobs to do that. And when I finished renovating the house, I took my property to the bank. I said, I have this house. It's in Baltimore. I don't have a mortgage on it. And they appraised it. It was almost $200,000. They gave me 75% of the $200,000, and that got me started. It's not as easy as I say it, but that's how I did it.
So, but how did you get into the car business?
So the car business was again somebody else. A nurse. So I used to work with this nurse. His name was David. And David was, he put in a resignation, and he had been with the company for like almost 10 plus years. And David was 38. I was like, David, where are you going? He said, I'm retiring. I was shocked. I said, David, you're retiring at 38? He's like, yeah, I'm retiring. I was like, what do you mean? Like, did your parents leave you money, or you have money somewhere, or you're moving to a cheaper country? Or he said, no, I built a car rental business, and I have 71 cars right now. And what I'm doing here, I make 12 times more in a month, than, you know, so I'd rather put my energy and time into that. And then I was shocked. I said, I want to have like a coffee with you and just talk with you. And then from that conversation, he showed me the steps. I think 4 months later, my first car that I bought in America, I started during the weekends when I'm at home, I would rent it out. I said, oh, it's working. And then, of course, I then decided to use my credit to buy cars. And now 13 cars in. And I just started probably 2 years ago. And honestly, cars make more money than houses. Houses have a lot of stress, and it takes a lot more time to, like, you know, generate the income back. So I was like, I'm going to try this. So that was that. People at work really, like, were my saving grace. Like, the people that showed me how to do things. The people you talk to when you first get into America are very, very important. Yeah, I cannot even emphasize that enough. Anyone who's come to America before you, or someone who was born in America before you, has something to tell you. It's something that you can learn from. So the more people you talk to, the more information you get. When you usually want to keep to our African, you know, maybe you're from Africa, you're from Asia, you want to keep within the confinement of that group. But honestly, the more you talk to more people, whatever you're trying to achieve, all you need is information.
Right.
And once you have the information in your hand and you have the zeal and the courage to do it, it becomes a little bit easier.
That's very impressive. And we want that entrepreneurial spirit to rub off on some of us.
Yes.
Yeah. And all the while, you're back in school full time and you're working full time as well. And how do you manage all this?
It's hard. To tell you the truth, Zenith, it's hard. Sometimes I wake up, I don't know my left to my right, but planning yourself, pacing everything is how I manage to go through each and every day. So now I decided, it's been so hard with now being so overly committed. Now I have tenants, I have people who rent cars, the cars are now 18. The houses are now 7, and so I now have a lot of people renting cars. I now have people tenants. I have a home to take care of. So I decided to go to nursing school with the end goal of becoming a certified registered nurse anesthetist. That's the end goal. So it's a 2-year course. I'm in my final year.
So I go to school Monday through Thursday. I work Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. That is considered full time because those are 12-hour shifts. So that's 36 hours. So, and then in between getting off from school, I have time to check on the cars, respond to emails, and then find ways to keep up with the laundry, cook, you know, and stuff like that, do my assignments. I do have a very strong support system. I see my husband has been very supportive. He does help with a lot of things, and he just encourages me. And people like you, Zenith, who just tell me, like, you know, it's difficult, but it's normal. Just keep going. And then I have my sister here. She's very, very, like, sometimes she makes meals for me and stuff like that. But the village is very important in all this.
America is very rewarding, okay, right, in terms of, if you are someone who is not afraid to risk, take the necessary risks to be someone else besides what you currently are, it's very rewarding. But America, you have to work. You have to want to work. And at the same time, America will rob you of the things we take for granted in Africa. The fact that at home you could just get off work at 4:30 and go and chill with your friends anywhere. I don't know, have drinks or eat, you know, gotch-gotch is what we call barbecues in Africa. America takes away that. There's no real form of socializing because everyone is rushing to make the next dollar, or they're rushing to take care of the, you know, kids in school, or sometimes schedules never really meet. Like, you can never really say the time I'm off, my friends are also off. At home it works like that. By the time you get off, all of your friends are off. So you lose that. And then it robs us of a lot of things, but at the same time it rewards us. So things that I've learned when I came here is people. You need to interact with as many people as you can, different circles, different social circles, and have discipline. There's so much that can sway you left, right, and center. America is fun. It's fun. But the fun can be dangerous fun, and it can be like healthy fun. So you have to like remain disciplined, know who you are, be true to yourself.
So just share some of the challenges that you have faced and how you have navigated through them, or some things that have just surprised you and have just taken a toll on your mental health.
I would say the first year that I came here, when I look back now, I actually suffered depression. When I came, how I had envisioned things in the reality of what I met in America, there was a big gap that was impossible to fill. Like, I couldn't even fathom how I was going to get to my 28 days have elapsed, and how am I going to get to a point where I'm now documented? So that honestly was a breaking point or my low point. And then coming to terms with, I'm a whole licensed physician somewhere and I'm babysitting. And, you know, babysitting in America is not just reminding the baby. If the dog has to be let out, you have to open the door for the dog. And, you know, you have to do dishes, maybe vacuum there. So you feel like back home, you see like a maid. So just making a correlation with who I thought I was, I'd worked 6 years, to what I came to be in America in my first year of getting here, I was depressed. And I hit rock bottom. One day I was at work, I fainted. I got admitted. I was at St. Joseph's for like 3 days. And the first thing the doctor said to me was, when was the last time you ate? You know, I couldn't remember when the last time I ate. And then he said, maybe you don't remember when you last ate. When was the last time you drank water? My creatinine levels were so high. My kidney level numbers were so high. I was severely dehydrated. And I couldn't remember when was the last time I ate? So those are some of the challenges, the very first challenge that I met in America. And that in itself created a bill that I'm still paying for right now. Yeah,
no, very important to find a village, because then you can have people to talk to.
Of course.
People to share your challenges. Oh, yeah, that was really difficult. Okay, so a young Mutsa today, what would you advise her or anybody trying to come to the United States of America? They want to come here and practice medicine. What would you tell them?
It's very doable. That's number one. Very doable. All you have to do, young Mutsa or young Mutsa out there, is decide early that that's where you want to go. While you are in medical school, after your second year in medical school, you can take the first exam. These exams can be taken anywhere. In Southern Africa, these exams can be taken in South Africa. They have like testing centers. If you're in the Arab region, you can take the exam there. Everywhere in the world, in the United Kingdom, in Europe, Asia, there are centers where you can take these exams. You could finish taking these exams by the time you graduate, and then you could actually start applying for residency as soon as you graduate. And then when you come to America, you're coming in, going into residency. The hospital might actually help you get documented, which is one thing I know they actually do. So that's the one piece of advice that I would tell myself. And not coming to America is tough in the sense of, this is the most expensive place I've ever been. And this is coming from a person who travels a lot and has lived in 3 different continents. You have to have, for the first 1 year, you have to have a very strong financial support from wherever it is, whether it's you or people back home or some people somewhere. That right there will either make you or break you.
Wow. But I didn't know that they now have, they have centers everywhere, you know, that you can do exams other than just thinking you have to come here and do it.
Scholarships. They are there. We don't research enough, or we don't talk to the right people.
Okay.
I would tell Musa to invest more time at the internet cafe looking up scholarships, because there are a ton of scholarships. There are so many organizations, so many people willing to give out money for people to go to school. But the number one thing is you have to have good SATs. So you first invest time into studying for your SATs. You get good SAT grades for you to get into college here. And then with that, it armors you to get good scholarships, and then you can come here. So I would have done that instead of going like all the way around to Europe and then coming back here and then starting afresh at a little, you know, like not old, but older age. I could have just come here straight had I known that that was the route, you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
How are you giving back to the community here, or community back on the continent? What are you working on?
So me and my sister, we went to the same high school, right? In the Eastern Highlands in Mutare, like I said. We found 4 girls that we are paying tuition for. They do not know us. We do not know them. But this is one thing that we take too much, like we take it personal to actually give back, especially to the high school that me and my sister went to. Yeah.
Oh, Musa, that's really beautiful. That's wonderful. That is truly, truly wonderful. So will you guys continue to do that? Like,
yes.
Okay. So you.
Sorry, that's my husband.
I
know. Coming from.
I just saw him, and we're winding down. So we are almost done. So is there anything that I missed to ask in terms of the coming to America journey that you think might be important for people to hear?
Have a game plan, like a solid game plan. Know from here I'm doing this, from this I'm doing that. It's kind of hard to do while you're outside of the United States, but you could kind of have like a skeleton. And your plan A should have a plan B. and know exactly the people that you're going to live with or to go meet, I would say we underestimate the very few, first few people that we come across. The person who picks you up at the airport will shape the kind of life that you're going to live in America, or the first 5 to 10 people that you will become associated with when you come to America. Those people either break you or make you, or they shape you for success, or they don't do anything at all. So that's very simple. That's something to be very focused on.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And I forgot to ask, what about here? Is there anything you do to give back here in your community?
So the houses that we have in Baltimore City, they're in, some of them are in the rough neighborhoods. And around Christmas time, I give like $50 Walmart gift cards to each household to kind of help out with the Christmas shopping and stuff. So that's one thing. I started, I think, about 2 years ago. We really enjoy it, yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful.
If you ever see an immigrant that, you know, African or whoever from other countries who are coming here, and if there's anything that you could do to make their journey easier, just go ahead. Just be their saving grace, or be their knight in shining armor, an angel for them, and just, you know, show them different. Show them how you could have done things different and could have gotten to your destination a lot faster. Right. Yeah. And then America is a very humbling place. You have to humble yourself. Some people come, they are professors of whatnot, whatnot. You come here, you'll be working in a grocery store. You have to be willing to calm down, make peace with it, and say, this is the starting point. It's not the finishing line, you know? So yeah, it's very humbling.
Absolutely, absolutely. So how do we say, so if people want to follow you, people want to find you, where can they, what are your social media handles?
So you can find me on social media. My name is Mutsa, which is 3 M's, U-T-S-A-H. You find me on, yeah, you find me on IG, and then you can find me also with the same name on Facebook.
That's beautiful. All right. So when you feel like eating sadza and any Zimbabwean delicacies, what do you do? Where do you go? Where do you buy this food from?
So the good thing is sadza is now found in most of the supermarkets. So that's a good thing. And there are African stores. You find all kinds of Nigerian, West African, East African, Caribbean stores. You find things that the spices and everything, you find them in all those stores. So it's so easy these days. Thank God the world is becoming a global village, right? So all these things, you can find them in so many stores now.
Yeah, this is true. You can find them. And you guys are lucky, you even have, I think, I don't know if you've ever shopped from Zimtak Shop.
Yes.
The Zimtak Shop, and I think they sell like mazoi, the things, flings, all those snacks from Zimbabwe. A lot of West African. I know we also have like a couple of Zambians that are beginning to sell. So things are becoming a lot more accessible now. Is there a Zimbabwean restaurant that you know of in this area?
No, none. Mm-mm. But I do know of a South African one. I mean, you do too. Swahili village. No. It's a Kenyan, right? Swahili. It's a Kenyan. Kenyan restaurant. Yeah.
Swahili is Kenyan, yes.
Yeah, it's Swahili. It's Kenyan. The food is almost like Zimbabwean food, yeah.
Okay, yeah, it's very similar. Like Kenya, Zambia, Zimbabwe. Our food is very similar. A lot of West African restaurants, but yeah, us, if you go to Swahili, it's kind of like our food.
Yeah.
Very close to that. Okay, so before we close, I know we talked about, it's a new year, 2025.
Yes.
What are we working on socially? Because I think one of the things we have found is that everybody in America is busy and busy and busy.
Nobody has your time here.
Nobody.
Nobody has time, but somehow we must make time. Because you see, in this country, whether you have a big title, a small title, one title, many titles. Everybody's busy.
Everyone is so busy.
What are we doing for 2025?
I am meeting people where they are.
Okay.
You know, usually I usually pour so much, make time, but I've often found, like, you know, my expectation then becomes unrealistic. Like, oh, okay, so I pour, I text, I come over there, and I expect the same thing, but it's difficult because there are no, you know, help. There's no extra help here. If you are a mother, you are the mother, you are the maid, you're the gardener, you're the one who does the errands. So you find most of your friends are so occupied with taking care of the family. So somewhat an extracurricular activity to maintain friendships or relationships outside of your nucleus family. So I am just going to meet people where they are. If you call me, 2 weeks later, I'm going to return the call. If you text me, I'll text you back. If you don't.
And I know people outside might be like, oh, that sounds so random. That's because we had talked about this earlier. And also one of the things you had mentioned, Mutsa, like when we come here, the social aspect of it is different from the way it was back home. That's just one of the things people need to think about, that when you come, it will be different. There'll be other things to enjoy, but it won't be like it was at home, where you can just go to the next door neighbor and the other neighbor, and every Friday you're meeting somebody and you guys hang out. Here it's just different. You have to plan, and sometimes it's hard even to just get a date for everybody. Just to have lunch. So, okay, this is the day we're free. You find that you're mismatching everywhere. But yes, right, that spills over into friendships or relationships. Because yes, everybody's running, everybody's busy, but you have to make time for your friends. And the reason I say it about titles, big titles, small titles, because sometimes you feel like you make a plan. If you and me would agree to meet today, it means I have set this day aside. I am not working. I'm not making money. I've taken my child. So for childcare, I'm paying childcare, right?
Yes.
Like, you have to respect it, and I have to respect your time as well. But sometimes people don't see it, so people are canceling on you left, right, and center. You're like, wait, what?
That's true.
Because everything in America costs money. Yes. Money. Even a day to meet to have lunch costs money. I have to pay childcare. I have to make sure all those things are done before I even go for this lunch.
For this lunch.
Or this day aside. Or otherwise, I'll be making overtime to help pay my bills.
Oh, yes.
It's really hard. All right, Mutsa, any parting words before we say goodbye?
Nine, I think I've exhausted almost everything. But all the best to anyone who is looking for greener pastures, trying to change the current environment to someone else. It might seem impossible, it's difficult, it's hard, but it's doable. We all have it within ourselves to do anything we put our minds to.
I agree. That is wonderful. And how do I say thank you in Zezuru?
Maitabas. Waitabas.
Waitabasa. Thank you so much, Mutsa, for coming here. It's been such an honor, and hope to have you for other episodes as we explore other topics. And for everybody, it is goodbye, and listen on Pod Ops or wherever you listen to your podcast from. All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So this was wonderful.
It was.
Yes. I was in my head, I'm like, I wish...